Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day before St. Patrick's Day, the 16th of March. Thanks to Veronica Rickard for filling in for me yesterday. I had one of those furlough days and spent it in a delightful fashion at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, where Randall Davidson, our former colleague, runs a terrific radio and television shop. It was a grand day. Today, we are going to be talking about school lunch safety, the first hour of our program today. If you were following this series in USA Today, here are some of how the headlines went. On the 1st of December, when health officials identified an outbreak of salmonella poisonings last summer, they traced the dangerous strain to ground beef made by Beef Packers Incorporated, a major supplier to the National School Lunch Program. This headline: for the second time this year, a Fresno beef company has recalled thousands of pounds of ground beef contaminated with a drug-resistant strain of salmonella. Or this headline: in the past 3 years, the government has provided the nation's schools with millions of pounds of beef and chicken that would not meet the quality of safety standards of many fast food restaurants, from Jack in the Box and other burger places to chicken chains such as KFC. That according to the USA Today investigation. Or this one: no foodborne illness has sickened more school kids in the past decade than norovirus, and none is linked as consistently to improper food handling in cafeterias. That was from December 15th. But on February 14th, USA Today reports by July, the Department of Agriculture will have launched its most sweeping safety reforms in a decade for the food that it buys for school lunches. Here to talk about all of those headlines, how they progressed, what the situation has been, what changes there will be, and making sure that school lunches are safe across this country is Blake Morrison, Deputy Enterprise Editor at USA Today. He's worked there since 1999, and his investigation of the impact of industrial pollution on school children spurred the EPA to launch a $2.25 million project to examine the air outside more than 60 schools across this country. He won a number of awards for that. He was part of the investigation that examined the quality and safety of food served to children at schools. Before that, he was 6 years a reporter and editor at the St. Paul, Minnesota Pioneer Press. He was an investigative reporter there. He attended the University of Minnesota and served as editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Daily, where he supervised a very large staff. He has served as writer-in-residence at the University of Wisconsin and a number of other schools, and we should say that he is originally from La Crosse. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have many of them. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Blake. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Did you eat school lunches?
I did, though I was fortunate. My mom packed my lunch quite often, and I'm glad she did.
I'll bet you're glad she did. Yeah, very glad. I don't think I ever ate them. My mom packed my lunch all the time as well, although I can't get my son to do that at this point. This is an incredible story, and you have made some substantial changes in making sure that the food is safe in school lunches as a result of your investigation, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. And, you know, it's interesting. What got us started was we took a look at a case not far from you in Racine, Wisconsin. Back in 2007, there was an outbreak there that really got us interested. And it turned out that the kids there had eaten tortillas. It was taco day there. And a lot of them got sick, so many of them that by mid-afternoon on October 31st, it was Halloween in 2007, there were about 70 kids who were waiting outside the nurse's office, and they were vomiting, and they were really, really sick. And we started to take a look at how that happened and realized that the company that made those tortillas, a company out of Chicago called Del Rey Tortilla, had made tortillas that had gotten kids sick before, and not just once, but many times, in 2003, 2004, 2005, and again in 2006. What struck us as unique about that was that the Food and Drug Administration knew that those tortillas were making kids sick. And yet, for whatever reason, they did not get the word out effectively to schools. And as a consequence, more kids got sick in different jurisdictions. And only after what happened at the Racine School did the government sort of take action. And even then, 2 years later, that tortilla company.
Were they able to pinpoint immediately what the cause of the sickness was, that it was coming from the tortilla?
Well, immediately, no. And that's part of the problem with these kinds of things. Foodborne illnesses are really hard to track on a lot of occasions. And sometimes the actual aftermath is charted in days and weeks as opposed to immediate. Now, what happened in Racine was very fortunate. The kids got sick quickly. And as a consequence, they realized that there was something in those tortillas that were making kids sick. But they closed down that school and a number of schools in that district the next day as they were still trying to pinpoint what it was the kids ate that made them sick. And then they realized, hey, it was the tortillas.
We are familiar, as you well know, of recalls of various products in this country from time to time. You write in the piece, given the past experience with Delray, why didn't Chartwell's, and explain what Chartwell's is, instruct its managers not to serve Delray tortillas in Racine? There evidently was not a national recall here. Why was that?
Well, Chartwell's was a company that is a food distributor. It supplies food to a number of schools around the country, including some of the nation's largest school districts. And what was unique about Chartwell's was that they had purchased Delray tortillas once before in a place in Massachusetts. And that was years before what happened in Racine. And at that school also, the kids got sick, and they realized that it was from eating those tortillas. And the questions we were asking was, why then would you again buy this same brand of tortillas in Racine? And the answer was that there was no immediate recall that was placed on those tortillas at the time they were purchased in Racine. In other words, the recall of the tortillas had expired after kids were sick in Massachusetts. And for whatever reason, the company hadn't communicated very well with its buyers in Wisconsin, such that, as a consequence, they bought these tortillas, and there was no great emphasis placed. I don't even think they knew, they told me, the Wisconsin buyers, that this had made kids sick in Massachusetts. So it was simply a question of communication, it appears, and there wasn't enough of it.
Right. These tortillas are made on the north side of Chicago. You also cite in the article some of the working conditions, and they are rather disgusting.
Yeah, it wasn't very good. I mean, what was happening there is that the FDA inspectors had gone in many times. And in 2004, for instance, they reported live and dead insects, including roaches in the warehouse. In 2005, they reported that ingredients for the tortillas were being stored in plastic buckets that had been used for cleaning solutions.
Oh, my gosh.
And they found, for instance, in a food warehouse, a storm sewer on the floor, and sewage water had backed up into the warehouse. These were the kinds of things they were finding over and over at this place. And the questions that they were raising, obviously, were what is coming out of the place if these are the things present? And the answer was bad tortillas. Now, finally, the government stepped in 1999, but only after, again, this had made kids sick in five different states.
Oh, my. Let's move to beef for a moment. There have been tell me about the process of how schools get the beef that they use for tacos, or the chicken that they use. What's the distribution system?
Well, the government, through the National School Lunch Program, is responsible for providing about 15 to 20% of the food that's served at schools. The rest of it, about 80 to 85%, is purchased by the school districts themselves. So the school districts do a lot of the shopping themselves, but the government supplies a lot of the ground beef that's used. And the process that the federal government uses for this is that they have contracts and companies bid on it, and then they have a pretty rigid testing protocol on some levels. Its rigidity stems from the fact that if there are positives that show up in the beef that's tested, in other words, positives for two big pathogens, one called Salmonella, the other a certain kind of E. coli called 0157H7. It's a particularly deadly kind of E. coli. If those things show up when the beef is tested, then that order of beef is rejected. In other words, it's not allowed to go into the school system. The problem is that the government's sampling system for years had not been as good as the industry's, and as a consequence, there were concerns that the kind of beef that you wouldn't want a kid to eat, things with pathogens like salmonella or E. coli 0157H7 in it, those things might get through to the schools simply because the way the government went about testing the beef wasn't all that good. As a result of our stories, the government has changed those testing protocols. They are now going to test them far more rigorously than they were before. They're going to meet the same standards, for instance, that your hamburger at a McDonald's or a Jack in the Box or a Burger King now meet. And you think to yourself, well, goodness, I always thought the food we were going to give to kids would be better than the food that we're getting at those fast food restaurants. The answer was, that's not necessarily the case.
And everybody would have assumed that all of this was being checked pretty thoroughly for years and years and years, and it's incredible that it was not the case.
Well, yeah, and you know, one of the things that we wrote about, you mentioned this when you were talking about the headlines, we found this case last summer involving a company in Fresno, California, Beef Packers. Now, their beef was subject to a recall after it made people sick in 11 different states, 39 people. And it was a particularly virulent strain of salmonella. It was drug-resistant. And as a consequence, they recalled about 825,000 pounds of ground beef made between these dates in June, June 5th through June 23rd. Well, the thing is, they also made orders for the federal government for the National School Lunch Program between those dates, 450,000 pounds. And though one of those orders tested positive for salmonella, others did not. And as a consequence, those were allowed to go to schools. Now, the people we talked to said the government's testing protocol is not good enough to ensure that those things that tested negative should be sent to schools. And then they say that those orders should have been rejected. The reality is that the government accepted them. They sent them to schools. And even the company that made it, which is owned by a Cargill company, didn't seem all that certain that what was sent to schools was essentially going to be safe. And basically, the guy said to me something along the lines of, well, thank goodness we haven't had any complaints. He said, I can only say thank God there were no outbreaks at schools related to any of these products, and that's not saying much.
How in the world could they take that chance? Number one, it's our children who are at stake here and who are at risk of getting very sick. Number two, you would think that it would harm their business badly.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does. And I don't think any of them are knowingly sending out anything that's bad. I mean, they certainly relied on the government to tell them, hey, this tested positive, this tested negative for these things, so it's safe. But you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the reasons we looked at this was because kids are particularly vulnerable to foodborne illness. Their bodies are still developing. Their systems can't handle the same sorts of bacteria that adults can. And as a consequence, the kinds of things that could happen to them if they eat things like E. coli 0157H7, for instance, are really, really bad. And when we took a look at all the outbreaks around the country, we found over the 10-year period that at least 23,000 logged cases of kids getting sick were out there at school. Everything from eating pasta to chicken tenders to turkey to chocolate milk, all of those things during that time had made kids sick. And the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, say that that's a gross underestimate of how many kids are actually getting sick.
Let's move to how food is handled in cafeterias. One of the articles said that no food has sickened more school children in the past decade than this norovirus. What causes the norovirus?
Well, norovirus is essentially, people are probably most familiar with the kinds of cruise ship sicknesses that happen when you hear a whole bunch of people on a cruise ship get sick. Mm-hmm. And largely a norovirus is exactly what you think of. It's a virus that can't be treated any other way. It's basically like getting the flu kind of thing, stomach flu. And what happens is it's usually the result of unsafe food handlers, coughing in your food, people who came to work when they shouldn't have, that kind of thing. And what we found when we took a look at cafeteria inspections is that the federal law calls on any cafeteria that serves food to kids, that's part of the National School Lunch Program, to be inspected twice a year. And part of the hope here is that they identify anything that's unsafe as far as food handling procedures and give a primer to all the food handlers on how to safely handle food. Well, we found that 26,500 school cafeterias lacked the required inspections. In other words, they had not been inspected twice a year. That's of about 120,000. 1,000 schools around the country. And we found there were thousands, 8,500 schools, that had not had their kitchens inspected at all last year. So these are the kinds of things that raise eyebrows about what's going on there and why we can't get these places inspected.
I would imagine there aren't enough inspectors.
Well, that is certainly one of the realities that's being faced by the schools out there. The other, though, is that some of them simply are not being aggressive about going out there and getting people to come in.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have tons of them coming in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Blake Morrison, investigative reporter for USA Today. They ran a very important series on the safety of school lunches, and their series resulted in, and we have yet to talk a lot about this, the Department of Agriculture by July of this year will be launching its most sweeping safety reforms in a decade for the food it buys for school lunches. We'll be with you momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, in case you didn't remember, is St. Patrick's Day. Frank Delaney will be joining us again this year. Frank is the author of many best-selling novels, Ireland, Tipperary, Shannon, and he has a new novel as well. He had a prominent career at the BBC before he became a full-time writer. He was born in Tipperary, Ireland, and he will be talking about being Irish and poetry and literature, all of that tomorrow for the first hour of our show as we celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Let's go to phone calls. We start with Jim from Bellevue, Iowa. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi.
I almost got cut off there.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, my mom worked in the lunchroom for years at the grade school serving food, and my sister does, and every once in a while I get a chance to see what these kids are eating. And one time I was down at my folks' house, and there was this prepackaged little peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I said, "Where'd this come?" They said, "Well, it's come from the school." And I found out that it's been sitting there for about a week and a half, and I grabbed it. Still was fresh yet, and I threw it on the dashboard of my old work truck, and it sat on the dashboard for about 3 weeks, I guess. After about 2 weeks, the little family of mice that lived in that old
truck—they
bit a hole in the plastic wrapper on this thing, cellophane wrapper. But they never ate that; they never took a bite out of it. And it sat there for about 3 or 4 weeks. And this is the kind of stuff that these kids are eating in school. And I'd almost consider it a non-food.
Well, that doesn't sound very appetizing to me. One of the things that struck us was we took a look at a couple of different kinds of food that were going there, and one of them was something that intrigued me. It was called spent hen, and these are old egg-laying hens, basically hens that are being culled from flocks because they no longer produce eggs at the level that egg layers need them to. And the market for this kind of food has really dried up. And Kathleen, you mentioned that Kentucky Fried Chicken, for instance, no longer uses these. Neither does Campbell's Soup. But for whatever reason, they found a home in the National School Lunch Program for years. And what we found is that the government from 2001 to 2009 had spent more than $145 million on this meat, even though it's very stringy. And what we also found was that the only other two markets that seemed substantial for this meat, besides the National School Lunch Program, was pet food and compost. And again, these are the kinds of things that you stop and you say, well, why are we giving this to our kids? Don't we owe them better than meat that otherwise would be given to our dogs and our cats? And I think the answer now with what the USDA is doing is yes, we do. We need to give them something better.
Lest we sit here thinking of our children who are eating lunch at school today and we gave them money to do so, or they're part of the free school lunch program, are we doing the wrong thing?
Well, I don't think we are, in the sense that I think that what you'll find is most of the schools themselves do try to take great care in what they're feeding kids. I think that the smart thing to do as a parent is to ask what is on the menu and where is it coming from. The problem is that most of the schools will have a hard time telling you where it's coming from, in part because there's no good safety system set up that enables schools to track the origin of the food they serve. You might be able to say, schools got this food from this company, a Chartwell's, for instance, or an Aramark or a Sodexo, one of the major purchasers of food. But then once you get beyond that, it's hard for the schools to know who supplied some of that food. And as a consequence, it's hard to know whether a company like a Del Rey Tortilla, for instance, which was responsible for some of those sicknesses that we talked about before, what their safety record is, because you can't tell what their factories are like,
yes,
whether the company's been cited or inspected, those kinds of things. So as a parent, it makes it really hard, and you have to push your schools to really be on top of these things.
Has Del Rey cleaned up its act?
Del Rey has, and when we visited them mid last year, they gave me a tour of the facility with one of the consultants they hired. The inspection reports have been good. There have been no sicknesses reported from their products. Whatever it was making kids sick based on what they were served seems to be solved. And it's a good story because it's a family-owned business, and clearly their hearts were in the right place. The issue was really, were they running their facility in the level it needed to be run, and the answer that the federal government offered was no.
Thanks for your call, Jim. We go next to Joshua from Viola. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. This comes from a young gentleman who went through the public lunch system and now has turned what you call it an organic farmer or whatever, growing most of its own food. The one thing, or the many things that that people should touch on, is that this is a problem, but there is many solutions in this. And at the foundation of food is nourishment, is the building blocks of life. And with children, they are the building blocks of the next generation to come. And one of the sad things that I see is that we are inspecting food after it comes out of the animal and off the field. And instead, we should be inspecting the facilities, be it if it's a CAFO, which is a confined animal feeding operation, which I imagine are most of the meat that is going into the public school system due to the economics of food, and it doesn't balance itself out. So what I see, and also the fungicides, insecticides, and pesticides, and genetically modified organisms that are going into the food that the children are eating, that you cannot test. And we need to understand that the majority of illnesses and such and so on are from these foods that are foreign to the human body. So I see as transitioning to a smaller economy supporting local farmers and families, and the families that send their children to school and support those people instead of large middleman industrial producers, because we're raising children on industrial food, industrial poisons, and we expect them to grow up and take care of this earth when they can't even take care of themselves because they don't have food.
Mm-hmm. Blake, is there a way to do that when you think of the millions of children who are in the lunch program in this country? Could we feed all of them in the healthy way that Joshua has outlined?
Well, I think that's part of what the First Lady is trying to do with her initiative on childhood hunger and obesity. I mean, there seems to be an effort that's being made now to push schools and school districts to know more about the food they're serving and to serve healthier, safer food. The idea being that if they buy things locally, if they look for organic opportunities, for instance, they may be able to have a better understanding of what it is they're giving to kids and why. And I think that knowledge here is indeed power when you think about knowing what is in your food, knowing where your food came from, understanding the ramifications of what you're eating and why you're serving it. Those are all things that I think are fair expectations for us to have for our schools, in part because, as you mentioned, these are the places where we are, you know, growing the next generation. And it's really important that what we give them at that stage is the healthiest, best food we can offer.
Thanks so much for the call. Katie is next from Onalaska. Hi, Katie.
Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
Well, I'm Katie Wilson, and I'm a school district school nutrition director for Onalaska Schools,
All right.
I've been in the business about 30 years. So I just have a couple of comments to talk about in the sense that we know that these are serious issues that we're bringing up. But as far as, for instance, the government commodities and the food that the government provides us and the statements made that we don't necessarily know where they're coming from, there's something now called direct diversion that we can do in our school districts. And that means that if I get 60,000 pounds of chicken divert for my school district, I can now direct divert it. I don't need to buy the products that the government is necessarily making in the commodity program. I take that chicken and I can divert it to whatever company I'd like to, even commercially. For instance, a Tyson or a Brake Bush or a whoever is doing business through the USDA, I can divert that product to those companies, and then I just buy it commercially from those companies. So if there's a recall or a situation where things have gone wrong, I can guarantee you that those companies are at my back door telling me immediately that there's a recall. I don't need to wait for the government to tell me there's a recall. So there's a whole thing called direct diversion that many of the states have in place, where we can do these kinds of things and you're buying a commercial product rather than relying on the government contracted products.
Well, you should be able to shouldn't you be able to rely on the government products though? That's an extra step for you.
Well, I think it's, first of all, it's much more cost effective to do the direct diversion, because what happens is if you get government commodities the old fashioned way, government commodities come once a month with a one time drop with a semi load of stuff. You have to figure out how to store all that. You've got to figure out how to deal with all those great big boxes. It's kind of an old system that we're all kind of looking at as to should we be changing that system, and it is changing gradually. And what happens is if I can direct divert, if I only get 10 cases of a government chicken nugget, if I do it the old-fashioned way, then once those run out, then I have to switch to another commercial product anyway. So I don't get enough commodities to cover my district for every day throughout the whole year. Somewhere along the line, I have to buy commercial product anyway.
I see.
So for me, for the student satisfaction, I like to go direct diversion where, first of all, it's much more economical because the company's already making those products. I buy it right from my distributor, and I use the same product year-round. And then I can also put out a bid that then reduces the cost of that product, even though they're using, you know, the Tyson, for instance, would get the chicken from the USDA, the value of that chicken. So it's a whole new system that's, well, it's not really new. It's been out there for a number of years, but more and more states are allowing districts to do it.
Blake, what do you think?
Well, I think Katie raises a couple of good points, and Katie, it's good to hear from you. We quoted her in one of the first pieces we did talking about the difficulties of tracing back food. But one of the things that I think is also interesting, we just wrote a piece last week about Huntington meat recall, which was a recall that was just announced for some ground beef and veal products. And one of the things that struck us was that the government told schools that we did not send any of this to you as part of the commodities program, which is true. They had not. But what took a number of weeks to understand was that many of the schools had bought products that contained meat that was covered by this recall. Now, this was something that took schools a number of weeks to realize, not a number of hours, not a number of days. And in particular in California, we found that weeks after this recall was announced, the recall was announced January 17th, schools began hearing about it on the 18th, then they got more notice about it on February 12th and February 14th, but not until early March did we see a number of schools realizing, oh, wait a minute, we have products that contain Huntington meat. We found one case, for instance, in Texas, where they had served more than 11,000 meals containing this ground beef to kids before they knew that this should be removed from what they were serving. And in fact, the day that they got word, they had served another 34 kids the meat that was covered by the recall. Now, thank goodness that the meat itself yielded no illnesses that anyone has reported to this point. But it certainly underscores what Katie was getting at, which is that we need to have better systems in place for making sure schools know what they're serving, whether it's covered by recall or not. And part of what makes this really difficult is that a number of the meat providers, for instance, whether it be commercial or through the government, their meat is mingled with other products. In other words, you might buy ready-to-eat burritos or tortillas, and those ingredients that go into those burritos or tortillas might come from any number of food companies. And so if you find out, as they did in Texas, that Fernando's Taco Snacks used Huntington meat, you might not know that for a couple of weeks after the Huntington meat recall, unless Fernando's happens to be on top of the game and lets you know we sold you a product that contains recalled meat.
Yes. Thank you, Katie, very much for your call. We go to Susie next from Reedstown. Hi, Susie.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My kids bring their school lunch. I have difficulty with them eating most of what's served. However, I have participated in the Wellness Committee, which is partly about food, and our community does gleaning, which is taking food from farms that wouldn't otherwise be eaten, and that goes to the schools, part of it does. And we have a farm-to-school program that provides both education as well as food from local farms that goes directly into the schools. Some of the things that get in our way of improving the school lunch program are government rules and regulations and how contracts are done. School contracts with food providers say that they can only get 10% of their food from other locations, which would be huge if we could get 10%. Other barriers include kitchens, school kitchens that currently are just heat and eat kitchens. They don't have the things necessary to prepare real food. And most areas, especially rural areas, don't have processing centers that are USDA certified. And most schools, I think, are required to have meat, especially that's USDA certified. So I think that there are some people doing some things to help improve the school lunch program. And I think that there's some real barriers, in actually making those improvements.
Blake.
Yeah, I think the whole issue about school kitchens is an interesting one, because we looked at that with the story about noroviruses. And one of the things that she mentioned was that a lot of them are heat and eat. And in some cases, that's for a reason. The problems you have, for instance, with contaminants and pathogens in ground beef is that you can kill them if you cook the beef to more than 165 degrees generally. And so one of the things that's happened is that a lot of schools are accepting pre-cooked ground beef. And essentially, it's beef that should be free of pathogens. If you want to go the freshness route, then you're really relying on those schools to handle it safely and properly, and cooking it thoroughly from start to finish. That's not an unreasonable request to make. But given what we found with the state inspections of some of these schools' cafeterias, it is one that probably should be considered. In Wisconsin, for instance, we looked in 2006, 2007, and then 2007 and 2008. There were approximately 13% of schools that cafeterias had been inspected fewer than two times. So that's a situation where there needs to be some emphasis placed on figuring out whether your school is one of them. And parents can do that quite easily. The law says that if you go to your school, they have to show you the inspection reports that were done from their cafeteria. It is required by law. If they accept any food from the federal government as part of the National School Lunch Program, the law requires them to make this available on request, similar to how people make, say, elevator inspections available by posting them in the elevator. So if you're a parent and you want to find out what your school cafeteria is like, go ask your school, and they need to give it to you.
Thank you very much for your call, Susie. We have some lines open now if you've been trying to get through. Blake Morrison is our guest, investigative reporter for USA Today, and we're talking about the series that examined the safety of school lunches all over the country and resulted in some significant changes, actually, with the Department of Agriculture launching safety reforms, the largest in 10 years. We'll talk more about those safety reforms in just a moment. 800-486-8655, or send an email if you'd like. You can do that. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, House Democrats are hoping that attaching a student aid bill to the health care reform legislation could attract support for the whole measure. We'll be speaking hour number two with the editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Education about the measure that could overhaul the nation's student loan program. Back to phone calls now for our guest, who is an investigative reporter for USA Today and contributed heavily to their very long series on the safety of school lunches. Blake Morrison is with us. And our next caller is Brett from Toma. Hi, Brett.
Thanks, Kathleen. A great program. And Blake, enjoyed this and also your school pollution series. But I know my ninth grader is smart enough to make his own choice. He says he doesn't like school lunch meat that bounces. said a friend of his dropped a hamburger and, you know, it bounced, and that's when he started making his own lunches every morning. But can you point out some places that are doing it right? I think like in Super Size Me, there was a Wisconsin school that was going more organic, locally raised foods. And
there certainly are schools around the country that are doing it differently. Let's put it that way. And I think that for most of them, the ones where I would say they're doing it right are the ones that really take an active interest in where their food comes from and making choices so that they can tell you. One of the things that I constantly urge parents who ask to do is to start asking their school nutrition people, tell me where the food comes from. Because if you don't know where the food comes from, you can't hope to know how good it is. You simply can't. And so that's the first question. If they can't tell you where it comes from, if they can't tell you where it's made, if they can't tell you where it originates, how do they have any hope of really knowing that this is good quality food? The answer is they're trusting others to know that. And part of the reason why we looked at this in the first place was because as a parent, when you go to the grocery store, you make choices all the time. You decide who to trust. You decide that you're going to trust this brand over that brand. You look at labels. You scrutinize food in a way that you cannot when you send your child to school. When you send your child to school, you trust others to do that. And in this case, the others are the government. And it could be the federal government in terms of commodities that are purchased and sent to schools. Or it could be your school government, the state government, the local government, the people who do the inspections of your school, the people who make choices about what to buy. But the answer starts with you asking your schools, where does the food come from? And if you don't get good answers on that, then I suggest that you probably have more research to do.
Did you have a hard time, Blake? The more I talk with you, the more I think carefully about lunch and what's on the menu for dinner tonight. And I think that if I were you, I'd be going to stores and not able to buy anything because I'd be plagued by the thought of where this come from.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, you know, you do this for a while and you start looking at things quite a bit differently.
I'll bet.
But, you know, part of what struck us about this, again, was just the issue of kids. I mean, at least I'm making a choice, and I'm deciding this is going to be something I decide to consume or not. Kids don't have that choice when they go to school. They are served something. And, yes, you can bring your own lunch. That is your choice. But for a lot of kids, that's not a choice at all. They can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And part of the purpose of the National School Lunch Program was to help kids who need that extra boost, who can't afford to pay for their own lunch and relying on the government to give it to them. You have people like Katie Wilson, for instance, who called in from Onalaska, very devoted to making sure that the food that they serve is the best possible food that they can, very conscientious about it. And I would say that that's true for many, many others in her position.
Oh, yes.
But the reality is that there are certain things that even they don't know. And those are the kinds of things that we deserve some kind of help in understanding as parents, something that tells us this is something that you can trust.
Thank you, Brett, for your call. We go to Joe from Sparta. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Kathleen and guest. I just want to make a couple comments here. My wife is a food service director in the state of Wisconsin, West Central Wisconsin. And I just want to put a plug in for these people like Katie Wilson and her who work tirelessly to make sure that these kids get the best possible nutrition and the best possible menus they can on a daily basis. And one of the problems that we need to face as a nation, and I've discussed this with my wife many times over the dinner table, is we need, the schools need, if you want to do the things that your guest is talking about, and more farm to school programs, more organic material or organic foods and diets, it takes money. And unless the federal government is going to come up with this money, I mean, they provide these meals for pennies. A good meal at a school is, they do it for like $2. Now, where are you going to go and get a good meal for $2? It's virtually impossible except in an environment like this. So if we want to do these things, that's great. And my wife and Katie Wilson, I'm sure, are all for it. But the fund's got to be there. The money's got to come from somewhere. And if people want this, they need to cough up the bucks. And they need to get a hold of their congressmen and representatives and say, okay, we want to go this route, so let's see the money.
Blake.
I think that's a very reasonable argument to make, though I do think also one of the things we highlighted was that there are some fixes that can be made that won't cost anything. And thankfully, that's one of the things that the USDA has taken up. One of our stories dealt with the standards, for instance, on beef. And though there is that zero-tolerance standard for those two bad pathogens, E. coli and salmonella, one of the things we noted was that fast food restaurants held their beef producers to higher standards for overall contaminants and bacteria in beef. They also measured that beef more frequently, took samples of it to ensure that the kind of beef that they were getting and serving at a restaurant drive-through was going to be safer than anything you could get anywhere else. Now, that was something that schools did not do. They did not do sampling nearly as frequently for the school lunch meat. They also did not eliminate beef when it had certain levels of pathogens that were eliminated, for instance, by a McDonald's or a Burger King. Now, recently, as a result of our work, the USDA took action and raised their standards. So they are now up to snuff, or will be up to snuff, with what the best fast food restaurants do. Didn't cost anybody anything. And that's a situation where, simply put, they lagged behind the standards of industry for a number of years and now have said, you know what, we're going to require the people who supply meat to schools to meet the same standards that they do when they supply meat to a McDonald's. It doesn't seem unreasonable, and it doesn't cost anything more.
Right. And are there other reforms that you would like to highlight, Blake?
Well, you know, one of the things that they've stopped doing, it looks like, is using some of the spent hen meat, at least to the extent before. They had a pilot program from 2007 to 2009 in which they were, again, looking for ways to do this, manufactured a couple of products called chicken burgers and chicken crumbles, and they didn't go over so well at schools. And it looks like they're not going to be doing that anymore, or at least not through that pilot program. So that's a very good thing. The other thing that they did is they decided that they're going to take into consideration the commercial recall records of companies that might want to participate in the school lunch program. You highlighted one such company earlier, Beef Packers Incorporated. They're the folks who were responsible for the recall last year of 850,000 pounds of ground beef, 825,000 pounds of ground beef last summer. Now, they are a company that had been one of traditionally the largest suppliers to the National School Lunch Program. They will not be supplying in the near future, and unless they get their problems fixed with salmonella at their plant, which had been a problem last year recurring, the USDA says they're not going to be allowed back. That is a change. Traditionally, what they've said is, if you can meet the specifications of the contract, then we'll let you play. Now they're saying, okay, if you have problems supplying good, wholesome food commercially, we're not going to let you play when it comes to kids. And that's a real improvement.
Yes. Thanks, Joe, for your call. We go to Bobby from Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on, and welcome to your guest. I wanted to make a comment for, you know, all the parents out there that are wondering what to do. See, if you have a local food group or activist group in your community, and also see if there's a farm-to-school program, you can usually look that up on Google or something like that. And if there is one, get active. Here in central Wisconsin, we have a farm-to-school group in Stevens Point, Waupaca. There's one in Colby. You know, most communities are starting to look at this now. The other thing I wanted to say is regarding the contracting of food. You know, UW-Stevens Point got rid of their corporate contract, and they're self-sourcing now under a really good new director who has actually increased the number of meals served just because more students are choosing to eat there because the food is better. And then the last comment, the last caller who mentioned the cost, you know, I think that's where it really the rubber has to meet the road. There has to be some sort of a values revolution in each community that people have to sit down and meet and maybe go door to door and talk to people and say, you know, do we value better nutrition and improving the livelihood of our local farmers? Because, yeah, there's no doubt that good quality food, local organic food, small-scale production of meat, you know, is more going to be more expensive. So I think each community has to decide, is this food and the nutrition that we're giving to the next generation, is it worth a little extra taxes and a higher budget for those items? And maybe we have to, you know, cut back somewhere else in our budget in order to promote the health of the children, which is, after all, the main thing. So maybe you can comment on those things. Thanks.
Thank you, Bobby.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that we found when we talk with parents and even some of the school nutrition people is that utter feeling of powerlessness, that there's just so much food that comes in on a given day, and there's so many places it comes from, that knowing much about it is really, really hard. And one of the things that we tried to focus on were some ways that people could learn about these things. I mean, one of them is to simply start asking questions of whomever is providing food for your school. I'm guessing that most of the parents out there, if I said to you, where does your school lunch come from, they would have a hard time telling you. And so that's a good place to start. But the other thing that I would really suggest is that no matter where you get your food, whether it be from a local farm or from the federal government or both, you still have to make sure that it is handled well. And this is one of the things that parents can take a very, very active interest in and really do something about. As I mentioned earlier, the law requires the school to tell you the state of its school cafeteria. And if you get good food in, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get good food out. If there are problems with how food is handled, you know, if there are ways that it's not being cooked properly or there are cleanliness issues in that cafeteria, those are all things that could make your kids sick. And so I would really urge listeners to go to their school and ask them for their cafeteria inspections. And if for whatever reason you don't get it, if they are unwilling to give it to you or whatever, shoot me an email, because I would like to hear about that. You can go to bmorrison@usatoday.com and just shoot me an email and tell me if you have trouble getting it. But I guarantee you that they will have it. If they don't have it, then you need to ask them why, and you need to get them to get that cafeteria inspected.
Can you ask to inspect yourself?
Well, I guess you can certainly ask to take a look around. I'm not sure how every school district deals with visitors in those kinds of situations. And I'm not sure most of us would necessarily know what to look for, except that we might say, you know, this place should be kept at least as clean as our own kitchen. You know, you have these shows like Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares on Fox now, where he goes into restaurants and he looks at their kitchens and finds horrifying things in their freezers and so on. I don't think that's the case at most schools. I don't think that's the case at many schools, or any schools perhaps, but what you don't know is exactly what you would find. And the inspections we looked at showed problems from people not knowing what the temperature and times for safe storage of food were in refrigerators, to rodents in kitchens, to meat, or in one case Spanish rice in Phoenix that had been kept a long past when it should have been thrown out. So those are the kinds of things that need to be looked for, and those are the things that parents themselves can make a difference with on a very immediate and local level.
Yes. What was that email address again for you? B. Morrison?
bmorrison@usatoday.com. And if you want to take a look at the entirety of this project, you can go to schoollunch.usatoday.com. schoollunch.usatoday.com.
Great. Thanks so much, Bobby, for your call. Polly is next from Reidsville. Hi, Polly.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment was that, you know, this is, it goes to a bigger issue of relying on the government and the states to protect the health of your children. I mean, when I was growing up, I'm 47, so it's, you know, a different generation, but my mom had seven of us, and she prepared the lunches and sent them with us. and she knew what we were eating, what we were getting. And as we were old enough to make our own lunches, we prepared our own, brought it with us. I think parents could be more proactive since there's this issue and prepare a healthy lunch for their children and send it with them to the school.
Blake.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, the more you can take, the more interest you can take in what your child is eating, the better off you will be. And it's as simple as that. And the reality is that for millions of kids around the country, 31 million of them rely on schools to feed them. It's not really an option to bring your own food. And in some cases, President Obama said this himself, this is the best meal of the day for many children, no matter what its limitations are, no matter what you think about whether the meat bounces when it hits the floor, it still may be the best meal that a lot of these kids get. And so the question is, what can we do to make it safer? What can we do to make it healthier? What can we do to make it better? And what can we do to make sure that the people who are preparing it in the facilities that they're preparing it are adept at knowing how to make sure that it's done safely? And those are all questions that I think can be best answered by parents getting involved as best they can in their schools and asking the questions that we've talked about.
Mm. So were you one of those kids who read Upton Sinclair and it had a lifelong impact on you?
No. No, I don't think it was. It's just my parents raised me to be a very curious kind of person. And so I started asking questions at an early age, perhaps much to their annoyance, and I just sort of kept on.
Good for you. Well, you've made quite an accomplishment. You must feel great as a journalist to affect change.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I mean, it's one of those things that we certainly aim to do when we write about subjects, especially things about kids, because when you're talking about kids, they are certainly quite powerless to affect a lot of what goes on around them. So when we write about these kinds of things, it's important that people take notice and take steps to do things.
Yes. Thank you, Blake, so much for being with us. It was an important hour.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Blake Morrison. And if you want to go to our Facebook page, we have links to the whole series, which you can see, which started some months ago in USA Today. So ours is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and that's on Facebook, and you can get a link. And his, if you want to send him more emails again about what's going on in your community, it's bmorrison, M-O-R-R-I-S-O-N, at usatoday.com. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks to Chrissy as well for taking your many phone calls, and thanks for your many phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Wednesday conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.